DNA unveils the monster humanity. Solving Jack the Ripper's identity threatens a lucrative legend. Hello, everybody. This is William Deadpilar, and this is the Red, White, and Rude, where politics is downstream of culture, and I, William Del Pilar, your conservative Latino, is here to break it all down for you. Now, let's be honest. We don't always talk politics and culture. Sometimes we just talk some great, fun storylines out there. Just like, for example, last week we talked about WWE's Joshlyn Grace and her move into the stratosphere of the rich and famous with her lucrative new contract. I crack myself up because when I think of her, I think, hey, how you doing, Jordan? Pretty good, Bob. Pretty good. Gives you a take. Look for that clip to be out on Grumbly's Media. And with that, do not forget, you can check out the Red, White, and Rude, as well as my other podcasts and the rest of our crew's podcasts at grumblingsmedia.com. As well as YouTube, Rumble, Apple, Spotify, and Pandora under the handle Grumbly's Media. So let's get into it. What is today's show about? Well, we are going to talk Jack the Ripper. You know, he's a big dude in terms of money, in terms of fame, in terms of legend. Or I don't know about fame, but infamous. That's our main storyline today. There is new DNA evidence that tells us who the killer is. And from there, we're going to go into the Rude Rundown. And there is an update with Neil Gaiman, the so-called feminist, isn't quite the feminist. Then we're going to talk about Wikipedia's bias through source selection. What that means is the only source left is rags. We're going to talk a few minutes on that. Then we're going to give you another update, a gaming update on Assassin's Creed Shadows. And then Super Bowl talk. We're going to round it out with a great Super Bowl, Super Bowl 59. Oh, yeah. I loved it. Why? Because I'll be honest, I was in the camp that the refs were helping out the Chiefs. It kind of pissed me off, to be quite frank. So to see the beatdown they endured against the Eagles, well, I don't even care for the Eagles, but I was rooting for them mightily yesterday, was phenomenal. But that's not the storylines for the Red, White, and Rude and the Rude Rundown. We're going to talk Kendrick Lamar's Super Bowl halftime show, a cultural flashpoint. And then we're going to talk that Tubi's 4K Super Bowl stream. That's a game changer in sports broadcasting, my friends. And we're going to close it out with everybody's non-favorite pop cultural icon, Taylor Swift's mixed reception at Super Bowl 59 sparks discussion on celebrity and politics. Let us get down to it, my friends. Okay. On tap is the latest in-depth information we have on the Jack the Ripper case. It's a mystery that's puzzled and fascinated the world for over a century. I myself have read many books on it. Oh, God, 30 years ago. I mean, I read serial killer books, Jack the Ripper books. I was into the mind of how people think, how they act. And it helped me out quite a bit. Going to over 30 countries, I learned a lot about human nature and the human psyche. And it's allowed me to be able to be successful and understand the bigger picture. Each their own in their research methods. But today on Red, White, and Rude, as I've stated, we'll delve into the contentious identification of this individual who we now know to be Aaron Kosmiski. That's Jack the Ripper. Why do I say that? I base that on DNA evidence. It was taken from a shawl linked to one of his victims, Catherine Edowes. One of the poor women that he took out. Then we're going to weave into the intricate tapestry of the historical context, the scientific methodology. There's a lot of issues, despite the fact it's DNA, the public perception, and the cultural impact, i.e., does the public really want to know who the killer is? And the cultural impact of that's a lot of dollars to be lost if we know who he is. We're going to, speaking of DNA, we're going to talk about the 100% DNA match that does not exist. But is it close enough? Well, there's scientific debate surrounding the mitochondrial DNA analysis and the broader implications in trying to resolve a historical mystery with contemporary science. We're also going to critically examine the critiques and counterarguments, exploring the irony of what I call tunnel vision. I really want to get into that because some of the critics say this, this, and this, and y'all in the looking at it with tunnel vision. I'm like thinking, well, you're trying to say it ain't so, Joe. It sounds like tunnel vision to me too. And we're going to talk about the mystique of Jack the Ripper. He's become a commercial phenomenon, as in big dollars. Does that overshadow the quest for the truth and the allure of a legend? Are there any legal, moral, and cultural ramifications we need to concern ourselves with? Naming a suspect so long after the crimes were committed. What about the poor dead fellow, Kaminsky? I'm innocent. He can't say that from the grave. So let us get into this cultural phenomenon, this infamous legend that literally ripped women apart, I guess. You know, it's, you know, I'm kind of excited because I love the topic, but, you know, you think about it, it's actually very sad. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, Jack the Ripper was an infamous serial killer. He was active in London's Whitechapel district in 1888, over 100 years ago. Nearly 150 now, give it another decade. He was notoriously known for the brutal murders of at least five women that we know of, and they were known as the Canonical Five. Let's give these women their due. Mary Ann Nichols and Annie Chapman, Elizabeth Stride, Catherine Eddowes, and Mary Jane Kelly. May their souls rest in peace. And you know what? I heard this on Tucker Carlson. It's so true. It's when you die, you learn everything. Was there an Atlantis? Which religion is the right religion? Is there a heaven or a hell? Who Jack the Ripper was. Right now, they are saying it is. Oh, let me get my notes here. It is Aaron Komansky. Let me give you my image here. Jack the Ripper. Hey, I worked on that graphic. I think it looks pretty cool. But that said, this is an actual picture of Aaron, I'm sorry, come out say it's Kosminski, Aaron Kosminski. You know, that's him right there. Who was he? He was a Polish Jewish immigrant and barber. You know, in my research, I know it's my historical research, they always say that. Instead of saying he was a Polish immigrant and barber, they always say he's a Polish Jewish immigrant and barber. I guess that's more on the impact that the Jewish culture has had on the world, good and bad. But that's what he was. He was one of the primary suspects due to his local presence in the area. He was also a mental health nut job, and he was eventually institutionalized in 1891, and he died in 1919. Wow, think about that. 31 years after the murders, he may have lived his life. And nobody understood if he was or knew if he was a killer or not. I'm sure some did. But here's the point. Actually, I don't have a point. It's just 31 years. I mean, 1888 and then 31 years he died. He was a nut job, though, you know. He was never prosecuted because of insufficient evidence. I guess what I'm trying to say is, in all my books that I've read, he's like a side note. Yeah, the Polish barber could have done it. Yeah. They always wanted the focus in on the royalty that it may have been the killer or the surgeon, you know, one of those outliers where you wouldn't consider it. You get a mental nut job who was poor, you know, it kind of takes the mystique away. And I'm not trying to minimize it, but it kind of does. But it's still, you can make many storylines on his mental health issues. I mean, a good screenwriter, whoo. So let's talk about the DNA evidence. Sorry, Jack, you're done here. Let's talk about the DNA evidence. It was a shawl believed to have been found on or near one of the Ripper's victims, Catherine Eddowes, in 1888. And that's what has been pivotal in identifying Aaron Kosminski. researcher Russell Edwards. I checked him out. He has his own Jack the Ripper tours, has done specials. He claims 100% DNA match between the DNA on the Shaw and descendants of both Edows and Kosminski. See, that's some heavy-duty stuff. People, men, have gone to prison on this type of evidence. The Shaw was purchased at an auction in 2007, and it contains both blood and semen. You know, they say serial killers, you know, they get so excited, ejaculate at a scene, you know. Man, that's some serious stuff. It's kind of creepy. What's the word I'm looking for? I don't know, just creepy, gross. I mean, to think that that's what it takes. And then it's, I guess what I'm thinking of is, it's not even the act of intercourse. It's just the act of what they're doing, and boom, they're done. And it appears that's the case here. The DNA analysis obviously focused on these stains. With forensic tests, they identified the blood from Edows and the semen was presumed to be from Kosminski. It's mitochondrial DNA is the primary focus due to its stability over time. So it's a type of DNA testing that focuses on the mitochondrial DNA, which is found in the mitochondria of cells rather than the nucleus. Unlike nuclear DNA, mitochondrial DNA is inherited only from the mother. See, that's what kept coming up in my research. It's only inherited from the mother, and it provides a lineage trace through a maternal line. And its primary focus of forensic science, especially in cases like Jack the Ripper, it stems from the relative stability over time compared to nuclear DNA, which will, I assume, denigrate over time. And it makes mitochondrial DNA more likely to be preserved when it comes to old samples like the Shaw. It's used to compare genetic material from different individuals, and it tries to link them through common ancestry. That's how they caught the Golden State Killer. That's how they caught a lot of killers in today's world now. And it can only exclude, not definitively confirm, individual identity due to its non-unique nature among maternal relatives. Keyword there, maternal relatives. So what's the controversy and criticism? Well, initial DNA analysis criticism. This is where the naysayers come in. No, William, you got to keep our lucrative Jack the Ripper business. I got my DNA witness here. Your Honor says it's not Aaron Kosminski. I got some millions of dollars to protect. So the DNA analysis that links Kosminski to Jack the Ripper, it was initially publicized in 2014. And that was done through a book, bypassing peer review. However, since then, it has gone through peer review. This led to significant criticism regarding the methodology, potential contamination, and the use of mitochondrial DNA, which cannot conclusively confirm identity. So, it was first brought out through the book in 2014, then what some say is a flawed DNA analysis, a critique of it happened. Here's the critique is what I'm trying to say. So the Shaw's chain of custody was not secure. Well, come on, it's from 1888. Of course it's going to have gone through various hands, but we're not trying to exclude him from going to the death penalty here. We're trying to see what is on that Shaw, and they found his semen, or they found semen, and they found her blood. And they were able to confirm that. So despite the fact it passed through many hands, increasing the likelihood of contamination, I guess technically it could have passed. I don't think he used it. I don't think Kosminski used it as a sock. So I don't know how his semen could have gotten on there through contamination. So it was conducted with techniques not considered the best practices in forensic science. Again, relying on mitochondrial DNA. You know, it's kind of like they're splitting hairs to me. This is still puts you more than closer in the ballpark. It puts you right on the pitcher's mound, you know? So these are people who are, they're not being picky. It's their right, and it's true what they're saying. But in the whole context of everything, I'm like, this is a home run. Maybe an in-the-park home run, but a home run nevertheless. So the interpretation of the DNA was criticized. It said there's potential bias. The results were initially published again in the book without peer review. And forensic experts, including Dr. Louis Lannan, who later questioned the validity of the findings due to lack of proper scientific protocol and peer review. And that's ironic because she's the one who conducted the test. I'm like, what the hell? You conducted a test, lady? So they said it was challenged because it lacked direct comparison with Kosminski's own DNA. I guess, in essence, they had the semen and they compared it to a relative here in the present that was a relative of Kosminski, and it matched up. But they're talking about they couldn't match it to Kosminski's own DNA. Why? They refused to allow him to be exhumed. Not that they could have gotten DNA, but if there's a tooth, there's still ways. But the longer that body's been there, the harder it is. There have been cases where they've gotten DNA, and there's been just as many where they've not gotten DNA from bodies that had been buried for 20 years or if not longer. So it was challenged because it lacked direct comparison, again, with Kosminski's own DNA, instead using DNA from his descendant. Debunking and the irony of tunnel vision. So eventually the 2019 peer review publication, In 2019, they did, by 2019, they had a peer-reviewed publication. It was a study by Loelanen and Miller that was published in the Journal of Forensic Science. And that was in March 2019, marking the first peer-reviewed account of the DNA findings. But despite that, the naysayers, that's not good enough. That's not good enough. Oh, man. People just don't want to believe. There was concern by the journal due to methodological and interpretive issues. That's always going to be the case with whatever, I guess. The debate over the validity of these findings continues to this day, as is typical. What I found ironic is when critics of the DNA analysis theory talk about tunnel vision and you're looking for the killer, so you're assuming this, they have that same tunnel vision and specifically looking to debunk it versus confirm it. They wanted to debunk it. They didn't want to confirm it, so they had tunnel vision. I just find irony in that they have their own bias and lack of objectivity. So technically, I guess you could say that the biases can influence all sides of the argument, including the skeptics. I call that selective reasoning when they were focused on debunking as much as they say selective reasoning and trying to find Aaron Kosminski as the killer. Tit for tat, tat for tit. No, it's tit for tat. Let's dig into the DNA analysis. Again, it was conducted by Dr. Jerry Loelanen. I need to know. Let's see. Loelanen. Conducted by Dr. Jerry Loelanen from Liverpool, John Moores University. And it was a 2024 analysis. That's why it's back in the news. It was a 2024 analysis. I just discovered it because it came on my timeline, February 2025. An article popped up on it. But I found it fascinating as this world, and I'm shocked that this didn't get more publicity. There are more specials, more. I love those In Search Of, or the ones by Shatner, or all kinds of shows. And I haven't seen any Jack the Ripper talk about this mitochondrial DNA. So I was a little stunned when I saw it in my time in 2025. Again, the Shaw was compared with the living descendants of Edals and Kosminski, and it supports the theory, and this is the best theory to the killer we have now, that Kosminski was Jack the Ripper. Let me give you a picture here again of Kosminski. Nice, prettier. Looks like a nice, handsome, dapper fellow. You don't want to be alone with him, though. Woo! Oh, man. So, you know, I'm looking over my notes here. It doesn't exclude him. The mitochondrial DNA only conclusively excludes, it doesn't confirm relatedness, which adds a complexity to the findings. And even with advancements in mitochondrial DNA's nature means it can only definitively rule out individuals rather than confirm the identity due to its maternal inheritance pattern. So, have we gone through the point of do not pass go without, no, we have pass go. It also included a modified protocol for DNA extraction suited to extract mitochondrial DNA. You got to remember, people, the Shaw was from 1888. It's what they had to work with. But they did use new techniques from what they had previously used. Because of legalities, they did use some visual aids instead of raw genetics due to privacy concerns. You know. So, over generations, supposedly, DNA can undergo mutations. You know, it turns into Godzilla. It's called genetic drift, which could theoretically affect the reliability of matches. See, I think this is where they're reaching. They're looking at, it can happen, but what are the odds that happen here when you have a suspect and the victim? You have their DNA here. So, yeah, it's far-fetched. I'm not saying this guy, to me, this guy's Kosminski is Jack the Ripper. But I understand their issues. But to sit there and blatantly say, nope, not him because of this issues, it's despicable. You know, and why do I say that? Because in modern forensic applications, the focus is often on autosomal DNA or specific markers that are less affected by drift over the few generations typically considered. There are limitations, again, to mitochondrial DNA. It can match with more than one person since it's inherited through the maternal line. This makes it less specific for individual identification. But it can suggest a pool of potential relatives. Again, this DNA is from 1880. So the fact that we have it is incredible unto itself. It's not degraded to the point it can't be used. Contamination, maybe, but they're able to separate stuff like that depending on how much they have. I mean, I think it'd be hard to figure out DNA. If you have DNA, then you rub it all over 10 zillion other things that have DNA in it, you know, but that wasn't the case here. There's also the lack of the direct sample that I mentioned. Without Kosminski's own DNA for comparison, the evidence relies on the assumption that the descendant's mitochondrial DNA hasn't diverged significantly, which is generally a safe assumption. See, so to me, they're reaching. Safe assumption for a few generations, but still adds a layer of uncertainty not present when comparing direct samples. In essence, they're saying, you ain't got the real thing. You ain't got the Jack the Ripper. And I disagree. Because despite DNA issues, it's still the most compelling case for Jack the Ripper's identity. Integrating historical and forensic evidence into one. I'm telling you, people. I am telling you. That is the man right there. Looks young. Looks young. In fact, I needed to look it up here real quick. I didn't have it in my notes. Damn you, William. Damn you. But he was 23 years old. Or would have been 23 years old when the murders had been committed. Young kid. I mean, you see it in his face. He's young. So this is the closest and most legitimate take we have, people. That bar none. Among all the theories and suspects considered over the years, this case against Kosminski, when viewed through the lens of both historical data and modern forensic science, it does provide us with what might be the strongest argument for identifying Jack the Ripper. Mitochondrial DNA does have its limitation. Indefinitely confirming identity, the match with Kosminski's descendants narrows down the suspect pool significantly, especially considering he was one of the few suspects living in Whitechapel at the time and was already under police scrutiny. I say that with, yeah, he's the guy. Historical and circumstantial evidence. Let's talk about that for a second. Because Kosminski's presence in the area, he had his own known mental health issues. And again, police suspect. It all aligns to support the theory. You can't deny that. You combine that with the DNA evidence, I'm like, bam, we got you, Jack. Or Aaron. Even if every piece of the evidence isn't irrefutable on its own, the convergence of all these elements creates a scenario where Kosminski emerges as the most plausible candidate for Jack the Ripper in the context of historical investigation. That's not my take. That should be the take of any common sense person. You compare that to other theories or suspects, the level of evidence, both forensic and circumstantial, against Kosminski, and we got our man making this the most credible claim to date in solving one of history's most enduring mysteries. I guess at the end of the day, you have to look at it from the perspective of approaching historical mysteries with both an open mind and a critical eye. I have both. But to me, this is overwhelming. And while absolute certainty might be elusive, we can still move closer to the truth through the careful integration of different types of evidence. And that's what we have done here, my friends. I, William Del Pilar, Detective Sherlock, William Del Pilar Holmes. So there is an interest. Nah, I'm not even going to talk about that. We can talk about third parties all we want, you know. But here's how strong the evidence is. Descendants of both victims and Kosminski have called for an official inquest to legally recognize Kosminski as Jack the Ripper, seeking closure after over a century. The public, well, there's mixed fascination and skepticism, with some descendants of Kosminski accepting the findings, while others, the public, remain doubtful. I'm being sarcastic. What I imagine is some people in Kosminski's family are like, yeah, he's Jack the Ripper. Cha-ching, dollar signs in their eyes. And some say, no. We a good family. Aaron Kosminski is not Jack the Ripper. I can't do a Polish accent for hell. Now, the academic community, that's a different story. If they don't get their name attached to it, he's not Jack the Ripper. But there's a division between those convinced by the evidence and those demanding further, more robust scientific validation. Where are you going to get it from, scientists? Aren't y'all the same ones who told us you ain't going to be able to catch COVID if you take the jab? You saw how truthful that was. So the cultural media impact, look, there's mystique versus reality. The allure of Jack the Ripper, it's a mystery that's built an industry around speculation and intrigue. Again, this is what people think when they think Jack the Ripper. Put a little bit of blood on it, make it a knife in the hand, and boom, you have fear of how evil can be, how evil manifests itself. Fear those in the shadows. Evil lurks in the shadows. Whatever the shadow saying was, you know, as a kid, I was like, brrr. You know, but that's the mystique right there. And it's going to diminish that by revealing the killer's identity. He's just an old barber, dapper looking guy who was in that job. I mean, this is a commercial, lucrative commercial opportunity for people, whether movies, books, documentary series, tours. Those people prefer the legend over the reality. So cultural narratives, in terms of how you can or can't profit off this, can influence historical inquiry. Meaning, no, sir, we don't need to know the truth. It's captivated the public for over 130 years. Again, literature, film, and tourism. This would reshape all of that. I don't think it would too much, but eventually, over time, it would. Over time, you wouldn't see movies and documentaries. What I'm saying is, for the next 10 years, you'll see documentaries, movies with Kosminski as a killer, etc., etc. But over time, it'll just die down. But if there is no killer known, the legend will continue. I remember watching Kolchak, Night Stalker, 11:30 CBS, when they didn't have late night. They had Kolchak, the Night Stalker, new shows. His first episode was Jack the Ripper. Jack the Ripper killing everybody, beating everybody up, being able to deal with electrocution, jumping down. He was like Superman, jumping over buildings. You know, it was like incredible. That's a mystique. These people who love the mystique over the reality don't care about the truth unless they can make a dollar out of it. And that's where we stand right now. Call it historical skepticism. Call it not wanting to believe a conspiracy theory, mistrust of science, human error and contamination, media influence. Call it all that. You're just hating the hate, because the evidence is as powerful as it's ever been. So Russell Edwards, give him his play here, the guy who uncovered all this. He published Naming Jack the Ripper, and that's the book I'm referring to that came out in 2014. Purchase it if you want to support his work. So despite compelling DNA evidence suggesting Kosminski's culpability, the debate continues, supposedly due to the complexities of applying modern forensic science to historical mysteries. But it's more likely too lucrative an industry in wanting to know who that killer is, my friends. Cause for further scientific scrutiny and possibly an official inquest does reflect the ongoing need for validation of these findings. Families of the victims want peace. Families of the killer, I don't know what they want, to be quite honest. What do you gain saying, yeah, Aaron's my man, he's the killer? Maybe they feel they can gain off that. I don't know. I'm not trying to put the get into their minds. I just haven't figured that one out. But this does, or rather, this case underlines the intersection of history, science, and obviously public perception. And it emphasizes the need for a critical and balanced approach to historical evidence. And I think they've given that to this case. Despite the critique on bias, subjectivity, and the cultural commercialization of historical mysteries, our side has done the proper testing, the evidence as best as possible. And with that, my friends, let us move on. The Rude Rundown. We are going to move to an update. The lawsuit against Neil Gaiman and Amanda Palmer, his ex-partner, alleges sexual assault and human trafficking. Let me sit here and show you who this man is. This is actually a pretty good picture of him. He's a quite fugly looking dude. He really is. Not a handsome man. He's a rich man. Got a big wallet. So let's talk about the lawsuit. So there's been four or five women that have come out against him already. And this is one of them. Her name is Scarlett Pavlovich. She's a former nanny for Gaiman and Amanda Palmer. And that is his former partner. And she's filed a lawsuit in the U.S. accusing Gaiman of sexual assault, rape, coercion, and human trafficking. That's some serious crap. She's claiming Palmer aided in these abuses by procuring her for Gaiman. She alleges that all of this happened, the assaults happened shortly after she started working for them in February 2022. So this is not as far back in the past as most people would imagine. The lawsuit comprises four counts of human trafficking. Wow. That's under the U.S. Trafficking Victims Protection Act. And it also includes charges of assault, battery, and intentional and negligent infliction of emotional distress. You think against Gaiman, Palmer are being sued for negligence in relation to these events. This has had a profound impact on Gaiman's career. You know, serious setbacks, my friends. Cancellation of upcoming projects by Dark Horse Comics, the scrapping of a UK stage adaptation of Coraline, the end of Netflix's The Sandman after one season, after season two, actually, and the reduction of Good Omens to a finale episode on Amazon Prime. He's taking a hit now. He may have gotten paid ahead of time before contracts, but he's done. Gaiman has denied the allegations in previous statements, admitting to possible missteps. See, what he's saying is, yeah, I beat her, I slapped her, I bent her over, yeah. But it's just a misstep. That's all it was, just a misstep. That's what he's saying. He denies the non-consensual activity. This is how that goes. It is all alleged. Neil, you know, I'm ready to go home. Shuts the door. How are you doing? I'm Neil, and I'm horny. But Neil, no, I don't want you. You want to keep your job? Then he may add, there's a bonus in this part of the job. Person needs a job. They need money. They feel pressured. You know, if they quit, the next person calls Neil for a review. Hey, how'd that person do?
She sucked. Or rather, she didn't. Don't hire her.
Arthas is a legend. You know? So he turns around and says, those are just misstates. Palmer's remained silent. She actually just came out just the other day, earlier this week, denied it herself. You know, and then she expressed disturbance over the initial claims. Woman, you knew what was happening if you were in that house. So the other accusers, because there's like three or four of them more, have supported her, highlighting a pattern of behavior. You know, when you got one, two, okay, three, four, whoa, five. Kind of tough to get out of that if there's any kind of semblance of evidence. So obviously this adds to the public and professional scrutiny of Guymon since the allegations first surfaced, meaning he's in hot water and it's just getting hotter. What is my personal take on this? Guymon's a freaking hypocrite. Guymon has claimed to be a feminist, yet faces allegations of rape, highlighting a profound hypocrisy between his public persona and the accusations against him. In essence, do as I say, because I'm a feminist. Not as I do. Come here, woman. Everything he's wished or accused conservatives of, he's now doing, allegedly. Karma's a blank, and she's striking back at Guymon, and he's paying the price as he should if guilty. Well, really, the price would be time in jail. But some of these may, I don't know if this one here still falls under the law, but this is a civil case, so probably not. Moving on. Wikipedia, here's another update. Wikipedia's bias through source selection. Look, I talked about Wikipedia during the holidays. Don't give a damn dime to Wikipedia. Why? They hate you conservatives. They hate us conservatives. Their articles, political especially, they're biased towards Democrat viewpoints, particularly in older articles, which aligns with the criticism of a promoting leftist ideology through selective sourcing. And what do I mean by selective sourcing? Well, the USA scandal has shown quite a bit of media manipulation. Now, they have not been outright bribed, but when you have a $10,000 a month subscription to Politico, and Politico is not giving you $10,000 worth of information you can't get from the Times, the Post, Breitbart, well, they're a conservative, or any other leftist rag, and they can't. They're not giving you inside information that will be broken out as news. It's a grift, meaning wink, wink, we'll take $9 million worth of subscriptions, wink, wink, for promoting our ideology. So government-funded narratives can influence public perception. Why? Because the only sources Wikipedia uses are leftist sources. It will not allow conservative sources in their write-ups on those pages. Everything's leftist. Thus, you're getting one slant. It's Politico, the New York Times, Washington Post, Newsweek, Variety. They're all leftist rags. In my notes, I put potentially suggest. No, it's an actual bias in the information presented on Wikipedia. In fact, Wikipedia's arbitration committee has been noted to sanction right-leaning editors showing an internal bias. And the comparison of Wikipedia to other encyclopedias like Britannica, where Wikipedia shows a more pronounced bias after not allowing revision, underscores a concern over source integrity. My take? This does nothing but validate my previous take that I did over the holidays on Red, White, and Rude. Check it out. Go to grumliesmedia.com, the Red, White, and Rude section, on why we shouldn't support Wikipedia. Wikipedia is purposely lying and has set up an interface that punishes all things conservative to create a perception of leftism, my friends. And that's manufactured from them believing they are pious. Their ideology is pious, while showcasing myself and other conservatives as vile and evil. You mark my words, people. Once Section 230 is tweaked, and if they're allowed to be sued, they're going to go bankrupt. That's how bad their lies are, and it would be arguably the most easy case of libel ever seen in the history I want to say jurisprudence, but I don't know if that fits, but in the history of lawsuits in America. Moving on. Let's have a gaming update. Assassin's Creed Shadows. Team Ninja sets the stage for feudal Japan showdown with Rise of the Ronin. PC release. So, as you know, through my my apologies on that. I'm looking for my image here. I apologize about that. Assassin's Creed Shadow. It's a great cover. You got to give credit to their cover art. Looking sharp there, Assassin's Creed. That's about the best thing for the game. Yeah. So who is Team Ninja? Well, they have a game called Rise of the Ronin that was previously a PlayStation 5 exclusive. It's going to launch on PC on March 11th. 9 days before Ubisoft's Assassin's Creed Shadows launches March 20th. And that's going to be a direct competition for the PC Ronin battle. Both games are set in feudal Japan. It's going to retail also for $49.99, $20 less than Assassin's Creed Shadows. And let me tell you people something. I don't have a PlayStation 5, my Xbox or 360. I just game on PC. Granted, I've only played one game the last 6 years with a touch sporadically of other ones. I'm playing the remake of Silent Hill 2, but I haven't played that in months. I'm not as much a gamer as I like to pretend I am, but I do keep up with the gaming world. And the Rise of the Ronin is deeply rooted in the history of the 19th century Japan. And it focuses on the story of the Blade Twins. One gets whacked, the other one comes Ronin. And it's during the decline of the Tokugawa Shogunate. And it aims to provide more authentic, and it's been praised and reviewed as extremely authentic portrayal of Japanese culture compared to Assassin's Creed Shadows, which has been criticized for all kinds of historical inaccuracies, ranging from the surroundings that you're playing in, the home, the trees, the flowers, to the fact that they're trying to say the protagonist was an actual samurai, and he was not. There's a 400-page book built off of 13 lines of history, and they're trying to say the 400-page book is accurate historical history, and it's not. Rise of the Ronin has become Team Ninja's best-selling title to date, and that's only on the PlayStation 5 consoles. So the strategy and timing of the PC release, I think, is to compete with Assassin's Creed, to capitalize on those who start to get an itch to play a game of Ronins, Shoguns, set in feudal Japan, but doesn't want to support woke DEI madness that Ubisoft has put out over the last 5 to 10 years that has resulted in literally 70% of their games underperforming and their studio being on the precipice of bankruptcy. Maybe not quite bankruptcy, but being forced to sell. That's not counting the cost of all the delays those games happened to deal with. What I'm trying to say, it wasn't just the bad games. There were delays and delays of the games. They just became a behemoth that went out of control in making a game. They forgot how to make a good game. Yeah. And the Rise of the Ronin there is a narrative of political intrigue and revenge. I don't know what the heck. And it actually has stealth. A lot of stealth in it, which is what Assassin's Creed used to be known for and no longer known. So what's my take? So despite all these negatives, I believe Assassin's Creed Shadows is more than likely going to be a hit. How big a hit? So for example, Dragon's Age of Veilguard, they say, is a hit. Well, on a scale of 1 to 10, they were hoping for a 10. They got a 4. So it made some money. Did it make enough money to... Actually, if it doesn't make enough money to break even, it's not really a hit. So maybe Dragon's Age the Veilguard isn't the best example. But this game probably cost a few hundred million. So it's going to have to be a monster hit in sales to just break even. I don't know if it's going to be able to do that. We're going to see. The problem with Assassin's Creed Shadows, as I've said, is it disrespects and denigrates Asians. It's based on race to play up a character in our woke era. The past four, since 2000, between 2008 and up until now, we've been living in a woke lie. And companies have been forced to play that game, and some have embraced it, like Ubisoft did, and they paid the price. They're on the brink of bankruptcy, being forced to sell again. And that's what this game is kind of like their last hit, or I'm sorry, their last game that dealt with it. I think they've learned their lessons, but this game was already done when they realized they needed to go back to the drawing board. So that's why they delayed it from the November release, where the game was already done and ready to go. It's also built upon DEI hires, where people hired didn't have the qualifications that they claimed to have had. Why do we know this? Are the inaccuracies of history in the game. They hired a group of DEI women who said they were actual historical historians to Japan and weren't. That's what I'm saying based off the research I have come across. They may have PhDs that claim otherwise. But PhDs is nothing but jumping through hoops. I used to work in an industry where everybody, Tom, Dick, and Harry, had a PhD. He had to get a PhD just to be a damn executive director. Disgusting. And all a PhD is, this is how high I can jump when you tell me to jump. People with PhDs are the ones who told me that. Again, Assassin's Creed Shadows shows a lack of historical accuracy and false depiction of its protagonist, Yasuke, who they claim was historical, but were caught lying. He was historical in the sense that he was there, but not like they claim him to be. Moving on. Kendrick Lamar's Super Bowl halftime show, a cultural flashpoint. Look, Kendrick Lamar's Super Bowl halftime show featured Samuel L. Jackson as a black Uncle Sam, and that created diverse reactions. This is what I look at. What's good for the goose is good for the gander. What do I mean is, let's have a white woman play Norma Parks. Let's have a white Ryan Gosling. There's a great poster of Ryan Gosling playing the Black Panther. You see with the reaction. So I'm like, whatever. At this point, I'm whatever. Get all upset. As a Latino, I'm tired of the crap. As a Latino with black relatives, black members of my family, white members, brown members, name them all, I'm sick of this crap. Kendrick Lamar has a black audience. That's his audience. And that's who he catered to. No difference in Taylor Swift catering to the Swifties, you know, a country music star where it's mostly white. That's how it is. The real issue here isn't who criticized it and who didn't and who liked it and who what, whatever. That's not relevant here, people. What's relevant is 1.3 million viewers stopped watching the halftime show. Fox is going to have an issue with the NFL. Fox has to do paybacks. Usually paybacks come in the way of free commercial time on other shows. Shows they can pick or shows that fit their demographic. You know, that's how paybacks tend to happen. But they have to pay it back, which means that's lost revenue, which means they're going to be all over the NFL. No. No. You get somebody that is culturally accepted by everybody. Because the problem is Kendrick Lamar's a black artist whose music is 99.9%. For black Americans, and to each their own. That's my philosophy, to each their own. I haven't watched a halftime show in 20 years. I remember I used to go to the Claymation MTV fights, whatever, when they used to do that. Now I just do something else. I go take care of an errand, go do some cleaning, do something that's on my list of to-dos during halftime. And it has nothing to do with who the artist is every halftime show. So the real issue is the 1.3 million viewers that drop. That's all, at the end of the day, that's going to matter. It was a hip-hop show built for people who like hip-hop. I don't like hip-hop, but I do like certain songs that are hip-hop. I don't like country. I like more hip-hop songs than I do country songs. I don't like neither. But there's more songs that I've come across that I like from hip-hop than I have country. I don't care for either one. I'm a good old classic rock guy. Yeah. But this doesn't score the NFL and who they need to choose and understanding their market. They refuse to understand their market because of the Colin Kaepernick knee. This was a big F you to America, and we don't care that Trump's a president. That's how I saw it. But did it bother me enough? No, I was enjoying the Eagles and Jalen Hurts and Saquon Barkley beating the hell out of Patrick Mahomes and Travis Kelce. What I thought was more important was the protester took his chance and ran onto the stage with the Palestinian and Sudanese flag. And it was unrelated to Lamar's performance. My greatest show of the halftime show was them tackling him, taking him out. Yeah, take that mother beeper out. So what's my take overall? Again, to each their own, but don't fool yourself. This was purposely done as an event to thumb their nose at Anglo-Americans. I'm okay with that. Why? Because I don't care. This doesn't bring us together. It creates more tribalism. I guess I should care from that perspective. But again, I guess another reason I don't care is that's a legitimate market of music that people like and enjoy. I don't. But God bless you who do. I'm a good old Sugar Hill gang. You know, I'm a black rapper. He did a pretty cool version, but Third World, I think. They sang it. I can't remember the name of the song. There's some great reggae and hip-hop songs out there. But they all have their own audience. What will happen, though, moving next year, moving forward, you're going to get more of a Beyonce, more of a Taylor Swift, more of the artist that transcends a variety of cultures. Because the networks are going to have a few words with the NFL over this. I think it was a failure. They failed to understand their audience or who's watching the Super Bowl. And that's a cross-cultural audience. Okay. Let's stay on the Super Bowl. Tubi's 4K Super Bowl stream. A game changer. And sports broadcasting. This will be quick here. I don't want to spend too much time on it. But Tubi streamed Super Bowl 59 in 4K. And it was free. High-quality viewing experience. Significant achievement. They did a better job on this at 4K than Netflix did on whatever low-grade streaming I get from them. Now, people were complaining. I didn't know Fox Corporation owned Tubi. Many were unaware. Then they started complaining. Well, you know, this means that they're going to indoctrinate us through what they want us to view, yada, 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 crap. I mean, enjoy the free stream at 4K for those of you who have 4K TVs and can handle the 4K stream. Tubi has a diverse offering of content. I don't buy into this crap of, well, will Fox support indie creators? Yeah, they will. It's a free streaming servers. They're going to take whatever they can if they think it's going to create an audience. They don't care. It's about money for them. So instead of understanding that this streaming of this game at 4K has set a new standard for how sporting events might be broadcast, y'all are sitting there whining. And that's partially my take. What did you expect is my take. Even independent whatever will use marketing in the most base whatever to drive up whatever to maximize its profit. In essence, they don't care what it takes to drive profit. And when you're a free streaming service that doesn't have much, if any, original content, they have a few original items, you are just whining. If you care as much about indie creators and what they're going to stream on Tubi, then why is Tubi a non-factor? Why is Netflix, Apple, Amazon, and others like the top dogs? Why? Because you like what corporate media has to offer you. You just want to pretend to be pious. You're just cretins living in a basement, pretending to be holier than thou and more pure than Jesus Christ himself. So wake the bleep up and understand the jig is up. We know you're just posturing. You don't really care about that. Idiots. And let's close it out with Taylor Swift's mixed reception at Super Bowl 59 sparks discussion on celebrity and politics. So what am I talking about here? Oh, hell. I'm sorry. I just got to show it. I do spend time researching. And for those that aren't aware, this is a picture of Kendrick Lamar. Not a bad-looking young man, you know. I know this. Being a hip-hop singer, rapping away. He's living large with the women and the party. It's just, I mean, I say that in an envious way. Yeah, but that is Kendrick Lamar from a couple of segments ago. Moving on, though, let us go to Señorita Taylor Swift. And here's an actual shot I found of her at the Super Bowl. Gosh, she's such a fake looking. But she's not my cup of tea. But anyway. So at Super Bowl 59, Taylor Swift was booed by the audience when they showed her on the Jumbotron. Boo! Boo! Bleep the matriarch! Boo! That's in reference to her. Bleep the patriarch! Oh, man. I'll tell you this much. She's can fill a Coliseum up, but can't get him to go vote. But then when you're 13 years old, that's a problem. She's too stupid to understand I need to stay out of politics because my demographic can't even get to the polls, either by driving or by age to vote. So she was booted on the Jumbotron. Then they showed President Trump. Yeah, go Trump! The Trump dance! Yeah! And obviously that created a big old buzz. Everything went viral. Yeah. Now, of course, her supporters, that's so misogynistic. So much misogyny. It's misogyny with the new sports fans. Misogyny. And others viewed it properly. It was backlash against Swiss political views. Like, shut the bleep up. We just want you to sing. And why were they booing? She's bleep the patriarch. Vote for Kamala, or as I call her, Horizontal Harris, because she's accomplished nothing but spread her legs to get ahead in politics. That's not conjecture. That's not me bad-mouthing Kamala. That's actual fact. I'm out here in California. That was one of the first things I learned, was who and what Kamala was. I mean, you'd seen her. Well, slavery of 15 minutes. I think we... What do I think there, Mr. Abe? That's who Kamala is. She's a dumb as a rock lawyer. God bless her. She actually passed the bar. How, I don't know. Well, I think I may have an idea. But, you know, that's backlash from her endorsement, from saying bleep the patriarch. But what this also does show is the Super Bowl does transcend sports. When you get stars of every persuasion there. My ultimate take on this is Trump's uber popular and Swift really is nothing but a bubblegum pop star, a la the Monkees. Hey, hey, we're the Monkees. David Cassidy. I think I love you. Da, 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 da. Those were monster hits. Or I'm a believer. Those were like top one, sold millions and millions and millions. The Monkees in their heyday and David Cassidy in their heyday filled up Coliseums like Taylor Swift did. She'll eventually be forgotten. David Cassidy and the Monkees won't. They got a few hits that transcended culture, that transcend times. And not, this isn't on Taylor Swift, but she lives in a fragmented society where only an X percentage know her music. Whereas back in the day, everybody knew these songs. The truth is, people, they're just sick of her and her politics, her stupidity and trying to be more than she is. And we all see through it. She's a pop singer with no depth or intellectualism, despite trying to make people think she can add to the political and cultural dialogue. She can. And that's not a knock on her. It's stay in your lane. Certain people, you can see when they talk about things and they have that conversation, you can see it's awkward. It's uncomfortable. It's not who they really are. One of my favorite podcasters is Megyn Kelly. And I saw that towards the end of her Fox stint and when she was at NBC. She wasn't being who she was. I recognized that right away. And it made me loathe her. I love her to death now because now she's her true self. Now, she may disagree with me, but that's how I saw her when I saw her in front of the camera. That's how I read her. And I think I was proven correct. And I think she realizes it now because she's living large in terms of, you can see how happy she is. She gets angry and all that, but you can see her happiness. But that said, there you have it, my friends. There you have it. I hope you have enjoyed this episode of The Red, White, and Rude. Once again, you can catch this episode at grumblingsmedia.com as well as my past episodes, especially the ones that deal with Neil Gaiman, Assassin's Creed, Wikipedia. I hope you enjoyed this look at Jack the Ripper and the updates and my Super Bowl takes. You can also find my conservative political podcast, Fired Up, at grumblingsmedia.com as well as my Points on the Board, where politics and sports collide. But I don't always talk politics, so it's a great show. We're going to talk Super Bowl this week and a few other tidbits there. You can find that at grumblingsmedia.com as well as Rumble, YouTube, Apple, Spotify, and Pandora under the profile handle Grumblings Media. Do not forget to like and share, I beg of you. Like and share this podcast because that's how we're going to grow. I am William Del Pilar. For The Red, White, and Rude. And until next week, my friends, I bid you adieu.